Okay, so this is Bio-231, the hybrid class, and it's Monday afternoon, August 31st, and we're going to start the integumentary system. And so does anybody have any questions other than the ones we've answered so far? You know where to get the lectures that I put online and all that kind of stuff? Some people find it a total waste of time. Other people find it helpful sometimes. So it's up to you. Oh, the ones that I record, all right, are on my personal website. So you would have to go to, do I have it here? Yeah, right here. This is it. Oh, no, that's YouTube. I don't want to go to YouTube. This one right here. All right, so it is scm.cypresscollege.edu/TildaJGober. And then, of course, you want to look for what? Human Anatomy Lecture 231. Click on this. And here's the fall hybrid lectures right there. So these are all the lectures so far. There is one lecture that I recorded, this integument right here, but I mentioned a couple of people's names after class. I forgot I had the recorder on and I was talking to them, so I can't upload it to the internet because of that. All right, so sorry about that. But today, we're going to start doing the integument lecture. Okay, so if you can't find it, email me and I'll email you the URL back, and then you can just click to that. Okay, so integumentary system, it's composed of the skin and accessory structures of the skin. So that would be glands and hair and nails and even a little bit of muscle is found in the integument. So some of the functions of the integument is, and probably the most important would be protecting internal structures from infection and dehydration. And so without the integument, you dehydrate very, very quickly, and you can succumb to infection because the skin is keeping all those bacteria out of your body. Integument is also very important for regulating body temperature. For instance, when you start to exercise and your body temperature increases, what do you start doing immediately? Sweating, right? And so the evaporation of that water cools your body down. That's very important. Thermal regulation is extremely important because that regulates all chemical reactions in your body, and you're just a sum of a bunch of chemical reactions that are taking place. Also, skin is important for producing vitamin D. And what's vitamin D necessary for? Anybody know what vitamin D is? It helps you absorb, actually it allows the absorption of calcium from your diet, from the food that you eat. And without calcium, you'll be in big trouble. We'll talk about a number of important reasons for calcium in your body. And then, of course, sensation. Your skin allows you to communicate with your environment. Like, what kind of sensations do you feel on your skin? Yeah, temperature for sure. Yeah, like vibration and texture, for instance. You have certain touch receptors. People can even read with these receptors. They're called Meissner's corpuscles. Allow people to read. What kind of type can a blind person read with their fingertips? Yeah, for instance, Braille, okay. And so there's deep pressure, there's light pressure, there's vibration, there's temperature, and I guess that's pretty good. Plus pain when your skin gets damaged. All right, the skin has two main layers associated with it. The superficial layer is what we call the epidermis, and then the deep layer, which is underneath the epidermis, is just called the dermis, right? So epi means on top of the dermis, right? So epidermis is superficial. There's another layer that we talk about in passing in this part of the class. It's really not part of the skin, but it's right there for everybody to see, so we talk about it right now, and it's called the hypodermis. Hypo meaning below the dermis, and sometimes we call it subcutaneous tissue because the cutaneous membrane really is your integument. So subcutaneous means underneath your skin, or hypodermis. All right, so epidermis is superficial. It is an epithelium, and it has four or five layers, depending on what region of the body we're talking about. So since it has all these different layers, would you say it's simple or stratified? It's stratified, right? So just think of every way that you can classify epidermis. It's by what? The shape of the cells and the number of layers. The dermis is the deep layer. It's made of connective tissue. And there are two kinds of connective tissues that it's made out of, and there are two layers that make up the dermis. We'll see what those two different layers are. All right, and so for a little introduction of the hypodermis, again, it's not part of the integument. It is loose areolar connective tissue. Sometimes we call it superficial fascia. It's not very strong. It separates very easy. So when we do dissection, or indeed if somebody's doing surgery, it's very easy to separate the integument out from underlying structures because areolar connective tissue is not very strong. It's easy to separate with just a blunt probe, okay, or hemostats or whatever can be used to move through that tissue very easily. But it is there because it helps attach the integument to underlying structures like muscle and bone. Okay, and there are a lot of adipocytes in superficial fascia. As a matter of fact, somebody might store about half of their body's fat subcutaneously, right, underneath the skin in the hypodermis. Okay, so what does this stuff look like? Here is a nice picture of the whole integument. So the layers that we're talking about, the two main layers, superficially would be the epidermis from here to here, and then the dermis would go right below that basement membrane all the way down to where we get to these adipocytes in the hypodermis. So you got epidermis and dermis. The dermis has got two main layers. Okay, the superficial layer is named after these projections, these convolutions or invaginations of the dermis into the epidermis. These are called papillae or dermopapillae. So this layer right here is what we call the papillary layer of the dermis. It's areolar connective tissue, it's highly vascularized, and in some regions it has these Meissner's corpuscles, which are important for light sensation and vibration. Not light, not vision, but what? Very soft touch and soft vibration. Very slight pressure. As opposed to some of these deeper sensory organs that look similar to a Meissner's corpuscle. These are called Pacinian corpuscles, and these are important for deep pressure and deep vibration. And you can see them down deeper, located in the dermis. All right, so the papillary is areolar connective tissue. The deep layer of the dermis is the reticular layer, and the reticular layer has a lot of collagen fibers. So this is the strongest layer of the integument because of all of that collagen. And even though it's named reticular layer, it is really dense, irregular connective tissue. Do you have a picture in your mind of what dense, irregular connective tissue looks like in your book? Okay, pretty much filled in with those fibers, collagen fibers, but they're going in all different directions. And indeed, there's so much collagen in this layer of the skin, right? We use the skin of animals, the hides of animals, as a very important product because that's what gives us, what do we get? Leather, right? So collagen basically is just those strong fibers that give us leather. And the epidermis is removed and the papillary layer is removed, and that just leaves the collagen fibers in the reticular layer of the dermis. Okay. All right, well, let's look in some more detail of the epidermis right here, and notice that it is an epithelium, and one of the characteristics of an epithelium is what? It's a kind of a strange thing. There's no blood vessels in there. Yeah, you might maybe were thinking of some other things, but that's one of the characteristics of an epithelium: no blood vessels. And notice there are no blood vessels right here, but in the papillae we do have vascular plexes that nourish at least the deepest layers of the epithelium, and those are the layers that are alive and growing and proliferating. Okay, so this right here is figure 5.3, and this is an exam figure. Now, the study handouts that I gave you have it listed as a potential exam figure, but I didn't include that JPEG in the handout for some reason. It didn't get printed out. But it is in Blackboard, so you can print it out from Blackboard, but I also sent out to production to get a copy that I'll give you next time. All right, but make sure you know figure 5.3, which is this one right here. All right, it's in your list, but you just don't have a hard copy of it. It's in your book, but not in the handout. All right. So what do we see? We see a nice basement membrane right here. This is, what is this, the line of demarcation between? What two layers? The dermis, which is deep, and the epidermis, which is superficial to it. So the basement membrane separates the epidermis from the dermis. And notice that we have different layers within the epidermis. The deepest layer, or stratum, is what we call the stratum basale. And the stratum basale is undergoing this process right here. What does that look like? That looks like mitosis. And in particular, you could tell me what phase that is. What phase of mitosis? That's metaphase, right? So this is the living layer because it's close to those blood vessels. These cells are undergoing mitosis, so this layer is proliferating. Right? It's producing daughter cells, and after a daughter cell is produced, it moves up into the next layer right here. This next layer, the cells start to change. They start to produce a chemical called keratin, which will give the inside of these cells strength. It's a hard chemical, so these cells right here are called keratinocytes, named after that protein that's being manufactured in them. And they start to shrink, and desmosomes make connections between these cells so that they don't pull apart, because you don't want fissures and things breaking apart in your skin. Right? So the desmosomes, and when they start to shrink, it gives these cells kind of a spiny look or a jagged look. And so that's what we name this layer after. So this is the stratum spinosum because these cells look a little spiny. They have little processes coming out of them due to shrinkage artifacts. All right, but notice that they're always being pushed up toward the surface by what? The stratum proliferation in the stratum basale. And as they're moving away, okay, then there are waterproofing kinds of molecules that are being released. They're glycolipids that is a waterproofing material that's contained in little granules within this layer, and they happen to stain very, very dark. And that's easy to see underneath the microscope. So this is what we call the stratum granulosum. All right, and of course these get pushed up to the surface, and by the time they get into this area right here, they're so far away from the blood vessels in the dermis that they're dead. And they're filled with a mature form of keratin, which makes this layer pretty hard, so we say it's cornified. So this is the stratum corneum. So these are the four layers of what we call thin skin, which is the kind of skin we have over most of our body. All right, so make sure you know we got stratum basale, stratum spinosum, granulosum, and corneum just in that particular order. Now, how would you know this is an epithelium and not a connective tissue? What's characteristic of a connective tissue? It has extensive matrix, okay? It has extensive extracellular material, but not so in an epithelium. The cells are packed very closely together, and indeed that's true because you see these desmosomes right here. So where is that keratin ending up? Is it ending up in the matrix or is it intracellular? Is keratin extracellular or intracellular? It's intracellular, yeah, it's within the keratinocytes. As opposed to connective tissue, what's the chemical compound that gives connective tissue strength? The strongest fiber in connective tissue is called collagen. Collagen. And where do you find the collagen? Is it intracellular or extracellular in a connective tissue? It's extracellular. Right, so there's a big difference. It's easy to mix up keratin and collagen, but yeah, please don't. It's in two different places, has two different functions. All right, so keratin just makes these cells very tough and hard, and collagen is a fiber that resists stretching. That's an important difference. We see some other kinds of cells in the epithelium. This one right here is a Langerhans cell, and it's an important immune cell. It protects against infection. You could almost think of this as like being a white blood cell. Okay? Not exactly, but it helps fight infection from bacteria wanting to get inside your body. This one right here is a Merkel cell. This is a special sensory receptor for very light touch. This works with a Meissner's corpuscle so that you can feel very light vibration, very soft touch on the surface of your skin. And you can see the sensory nerve ending right here. And then we have this guy right here. Here's another cell in the stratum basale. And its job is to make a pigment. And And yeah, it's called a melanocyte. So guess what the name of that pigment is?
Melanin.
It's called melanin. So what the heck is a pigment? Anybody know what a pigment is? It has color, all right? And the reason why it has color is because it absorbs light. A pigment absorbs light. Now, what kind of colors are in sunlight? Every color of the rainbow, right? And you can figure out what that is by just remembering Roy G. Biv, that imaginary person's name that just represents all the colors of the rainbow. R stands for
red,
and O and Roy stands for orange, right? Yellow, green, indigo, blue, violet. So those are the colors of the rainbow. And what a pigment does is that it might absorb all of those colors, and then what will that color look like to your eye if it absorbs all the colors? Okay, you know what? It's going to look black. Okay, it's going to look black. And if it absorbs no colors, if it reflects all the colors of the rainbow back to your eye, then it looks white to you. Okay? But if it looks yellow, what's going on with yellow? If it's a yellow pigment, what's it doing? It's absorbing everything but yellow, and it's reflecting the yellow wavelength back to you. All right? So a pigment is just something that presents a color to your eye because it absorbs some wavelengths of light, some energies of light, but not others. All right. And this one right here, melanin, is specifically designed, it has evolved specifically to absorb ultraviolet light, which our eyes don't see, but ultraviolet light is a very high energy wavelength, and it's especially damaging to these chromosomes right here. All right, so when you go out in sunlight, you subject yourself to ultraviolet light, and that ages your skin, it kills blood vessels in your skin, and it causes mutations of these chromosomes right here, and that eventually leads to, if you get a mutation, what could that lead to? To cancer, like skin cancer. And some of the worst kinds of cancers actually are due to cancers that develop, this is an irony, develop in these melanocytes. That would be called a melanoma, right? That's a very aggressive type of cancer. Okay. And maybe it's because it absorbs that kind of light. Maybe that would be a rationale. But you see these processes coming off of the melanocyte, and there's melanin in there that absorbs ultraviolet light, protecting the keratinocytes, especially the living ones. And it also absorbs other kinds of colors of light too. So typically, it absorbs almost all sunlight, at least visible light, so it has a brown to black appearance. Right? And the more melanocytes that a person has in their skin, and the more melanin those melanocytes produce, the darker their skin is. But what does that mean? That means that their skin is protected to the maximum, right, from sunlight. So it's very protective. So melanin is just a natural sunscreen that somebody has. And if somebody's very fair skin and they don't have melanocytes or very active melanocytes, then what happens to them when they go out in the sunlight? Well, they burn very quickly as a result of that, okay? All right, so that's the layers and some important cells of the epidermis. All right, so don't forget the deepest layer is the stratum basale. That's the living layer. And what do these cells kind of look like here? This one kind of looks a little columnar. This one sort of is cuboidal, right? But by the time they move up into the stratum corneum, what is their shape? They're squamous, right? So these columnar cells are living, these squamous cells are dead, so there's a transition not only in shape, but in the living processes of those cells as well. All right, so I think that's what we see in this slide right here. Cells move from the stratum basale to the stratum corneum, and they change their shape from columnar to squamous. Okay. All right, so we talked about these different layers. The stratum basale sometimes goes by another name. If you take a seed, right, like a corn seed or something, popcorn, it's probably still alive in there if you haven't popped it, and if you put it in a wet environment, guess what's going to happen to that seed, or a kidney bean or something? It's going to start to grow. It's going to sprout a root and a stem, and when a seed comes to life, we call that germination, right? So the stratum germinativum is what the living layer that's producing more cells by mitosis. And when a seed germinates, guess what process it has to undergo? Germination, but there's mitosis taking place, right? The plant is getting bigger. by mitosis. It's one of the functions of mitosis, right, is for growth. Okay. Okay, well, we have a couple of different kinds of skin. And this is the kind of skin that we were looking at so far. Here is the basement membrane that attaches the epidermis to the dermis. Here's the papillary layer of the dermis, and this is the reticular layer. Notice all these collagen fibers in there. All right, but let's focus our attention back on the epidermis. This is the first layer, namely the stratum basale, right here, and then this is the stratum spinosum, and then stratum granulosum. These have some granules in them right here. That's the stratum granulosum, the next superficial layer. And then these are the dead keratinocytes filled with keratin. This is the stratum corneum, right? So these are the four layers, basale, spinosum, granulosum, and corneum right here. This is what we have over most of our body, but on the palms of our hands, soles of our feet, we have this kind of skin. We call this thick skin. Notice the difference in thickness of the most superficial layer. This is the stratum corneum. Does that look a lot thicker than this one right here? Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So that's one major difference. Another major difference is that there is an additional layer. So let's look at these layers. All right, so we got the basement membrane. What are these guys called again? Dermal papillae. Right, dermal papillae, they're loaded with blood vessels, so those blood vessels are bringing nutrients and oxygen to these proliferative cells in the stratum basale. And you might even see some cells that kind of look brown to black in this region here. Those would be the melanocytes producing melanin in the stratum basale. And then those cells move up into the stratum spinosum. So here's stratum spinosum right here. And then they get pushed up into the stratum granulosum, and that's a really thin layer. And then they get pushed up into the next layer. There's a little dropout of signal right through here. All right, so in thick skin, this is an additional layer. We call that the stratum lucidum, for meaning clear. That's the clear area. And because when you're speaking clearly, what does somebody say? Oh, you're lucid. Okay, every once in a while. And then these cells move up into the stratum corneum. So thick skin has that stratum lucidum, a really thick stratum corneum, but it also has these much more recognizable dermal papillae as well. So these dermal papillae in thick skin can come together and they can actually push up on the epidermis. And they form, if you look at your fingertips, what do you see on the surface of your fingertips? Fingerprints. Yeah, fingerprints. So these dermal papillae actually help form fingerprints on the soles of your feet and on your hands as a result of that. The other thing that I notice here is look at all these collagen fibers down in the reticular layer of the dermis. And that's the layer that really gives your skin a lot of strength. Okay. Okay, so that's something about the epidermis. So make sure you know all these different layers right here. Okay, the dermis. The papillary layer is areolar, connective tissue. And can you remember what that's like? It has these fibers going every which way. Could be elastic fibers in there. Could be collagen fibers. Just not a lot of collagen. There's just some collagen in various places. And so the papillary layer is not very strong, but the reticular layer, which is the deep layer, is really strong. Its strength comes from collagen as well as elastic and some reticular fibers. These are oriented in all different directions, so skin resists being stretched in all different kinds of directions, but you can overstretch skin. For instance, during a pregnancy or something, when your body grows very, very rapidly because the fetus is growing very, very rapidly, the skin really can't keep up, and that damages the collagen fibers, and that produces striae, right, which we commonly call birthmarks. Okay. So is collagen intracellular or extracellular in that reticular layer? It's extracellular because it's connective tissue. All right, name the cell that produces collagen, elastic, and reticular fibers in the deep layer of the dermis. What kind of cell does that? kind of cell does that? What kind of cell produces fibers? A fibroblast. That's right, a fibroblast. Okay? So that makes pretty good sense. Okay. So I think I talked about all this stuff already. Okay, skin color. We'll talk about skin color for a little bit. There are pigments, okay, namely melanin that's in the skin produced by melanocytes. But there's another pigment running around in there too, and that is you have blood in the papillary layer, and blood has color to it, right? So what color is blood?
Purple.
Yeah, I was trying to trick you, okay? Well, it could be blue or it could be red, depending on the state of oxygen, right? If it's nice oxygenated arterial blood, it's going to be bright red. If it's deoxygenated a little bit, it's going to have more of a bluish tint to it. And maybe some people would say purple. I don't know. Is purple, is it more purple or more blue? I don't know. Remember, color is not my really big thing. But since it has color, there are pigments. There's hemoglobin in blood. So these contribute to skin color. All right, so don't forget, melanin is a natural sunscreen. It's brown to black. Then melanocytes produce melanin in the stratum basale. And people can have moles or age spots, and that's an increased number of melanocytes just in one small area of your body. That's why moles have a tendency to look darker. Freckles is just a small area of your body, and melanin is incorporating a little bit of an iron molecule, which even gives it a little bit more reddish color to it. All right. Then there is a condition called albinism, and it's an abnormal condition, but it's not really a disease state. It's just not normal because most of the population doesn't have it. Very, very few people have it, but it is inherited from your parents, and it is congenital, and people with albinism lack an enzyme to produce melanin, so their body is completely devoid of that particular pigment, so they're going to have all the features that they got from their parents, right? But they're going to be completely white. Or actually, they still have blood in them, so how are they going to look? The blood is going to kind of come through because it's not being blocked out by other pigments. So they're going to have a pinkish color to them, right? And their hair will be completely white and nice pink eyes and completely white and pink skin as a result of that. And not just people, but all mammals, there's always a subpopulation of animals that have albinism. Like these people that show tigers in Las Vegas, they have some albino tigers. Who are these people? If they're still alive, if they didn't get eaten yet by their pets. Okay, and where I grew up, there was a clan of albino squirrels that would run around. They were pretty good. I don't think any of them are still alive anymore because they're so easy to see that animals would get them all the time. Okay, so it's a trait that has a tendency to die out because it doesn't camouflage very well. But it's not terribly dangerous, except for what? Do we see many people with albinism here in Los Angeles?
No,
because you go outside, you'd get sunburn in just about 60 seconds, right? So we don't see many here, but where would you expect to see a fairly good population, large, someplace way up north where the sun isn't so strong? Like Seattle, maybe Minneapolis, okay? Probably especially Seattle because there's a lot of cloud cover too. Yeah. Well, Australia is, depending on, it's a pretty big country, but a lot of Australia is really close to the equator, and that'd be one of the worst places, okay, is Australia. But is there, I'd have to look into that if there is. I would not necessarily think so. Because if I think of Australian, I always think of seeing somebody with a hat on because the sun is so strong that they don't even think about going outside without wearing a hat. Are you from Australia?
No.
Okay. 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 You just thought, I don't know, maybe there's some way to research that. Okay. That could be due to something called the Founder's Effect. Do we have any biologists in class? Founder's Effect? Okay, cyanosis, that's another cause of skin color, and that is, remember, blood could be red, could be blue if it's deoxygenated, so somebody in respiratory distress or heart failure or respiratory failure or respiratory distress that is not oxygenating their blood. Their blood turns blue, so instead of looking pinkish, they're going to have a blue cast to them, and that's what we call cyanosis. That's very important for a newborn baby, right? So that's one of the things that's looked at right away, as well as what heart rate and respiratory rate, but also skin color, because that could be an indication of some anatomic problem with their cardiovascular system. Maybe the heart isn't put together quite right, or blood vessels coming off the heart are in the wrong position, right? So does anybody know what these things are ranked, and then you get a number that ranks the health of a newborn baby immediately? What's that called? Like an Apgar score, right? So the color of the baby goes into that Apgar score. And jaundice, that's another skin color.
Yellow.
That's a yellow color. And that's because what's that pigment in red blood cells? It's called hemoglobin. It carries oxygen. It has a red color. And remember, red blood cells don't live for very long. They break down, and all that hemoglobin, I forget how many molecules are in one red blood cell. It might be as many as 200 million hemoglobins in a red blood cell. That has to be broken down, and as it's broken down, it turns into a yellow color. They call bilirubin and biliverdin, and then your liver gets rid of that compound because it's pretty toxic. All right? So somebody can become jaundiced if they're losing way too many red blood cells, if it's very rapid destruction of red blood cells, or if their liver is damaged and it can't process the bilirubin that produces jaundice. All right, so somebody that maybe has liver cancer or chemotherapy that's particularly tough on the liver will produce jaundice. But also newborn babies, again, skin color. If there's a condition called erythroblastosis fetalis, if there's a immunological imbalance between the maternal blood supply and the fetal blood supply, there can be an interaction where the mom's antibodies actually kill the fetus's red blood cells in utero, then a baby will be born jaundiced. Okay, usually we can prevent that from happening, but every once in a while it's not prevented, and then you have to treat that baby for that increased bilirubin that's in their body. Okay, but hopefully there's no liver damage there. And we all can have different birthmarks in different places of our body, and that's just due to an accumulation of different vascular plexes that are close to the surface of the skin, which will be a little bit darker. Okay, some accessory structures. I guess maybe I'm just going to go back to that picture. Accessory structures. So you got what? The epidermis, make sure you know the layers. The dermis, know the layers. And then accessory structures. For instance, hair. The part of a hair that's above the surface of the skin is called the hair shaft. Right, and then the part of the hair fiber that's below is called the hair root, okay, and then the deeper part down over here is the bulb. And this whole structure is what we call the hair follicle. And a hair is made out of keratinocytes. So what's the hard chemical compound that's in every hair fiber? It's keratin. But instead of coming off in sheets, flat sheets, like in the epidermis, the keratinocytes are coming off in columns. Right, the desmosomes are hooking up, so it produces more of a columnar array of keratinocytes, and they're filled with keratin. And what do you think is harder? Is hair harder or is your skin harder? You know what? I think hair is harder, actually. So I think there's more keratin in hair, and hair actually protects your epidermis because it has more keratin in it. Hair is actually a tougher material. All right, and it's pigmented because there are melanocytes in the hair bulb over here. And what else did I have to say about hair? Oh, yeah, let's talk about this. Okay, a hair follicle is what we call a reservoir of epidermal cells. Okay, now what the heck does that mean, and what's the importance? A lot of times when people first start studying anatomy, they just think learning layers of things is just a bunch of busy work, okay? But it's really important because that's how we stage a lot of disease processes. As a matter of fact, one of the most important things, which is pretty mundane when you first started looking at histology, what was one thing that I said your eye should key on immediately? One of the first things to help understand if it's an epithelium and a healthy epithelium. It's what? It's that basement membrane, right? It should be nice and smooth. It shouldn't be jagged because that could be a carcinoma in there, right? So knowing layers of things is very important clinically. So let's follow this, not just basement membrane, but let's follow that proliferative, what's a proliferative layer in the epidermis? What's that called? The layer that's growing. The stratum basale. And look how it's curving around, all right? And then it forms this gland. We'll get back to the gland in a minute. And then, where does that stratum basale go? All the way deep down into the dermis, even into the reticular layer of the dermis. So these are what? These are the proliferative layer of the epidermis, right? So we say that a hair follicle is a reservoir of these epidermal cells. All right, well, let's relate that to something that might be poignant right now. We have a lot of fires happening around in Los Angeles, and nobody's really been burned bad. A couple people tried to ride out a firestorm. They were in their jacuzzi, and I don't know how badly they got burned. It seems plausible, but it didn't work. Okay, for them. I don't know if they jumped out because it got too hot or what happened, but they got burned really bad. So let's talk about some burns, because burns can damage, of course, your integument, and then you're susceptible to, what are the two main things you got to be concerned about immediately? Dehydration and bacteria infection, right? Okay. So the slightest kind of burn is a first degree burn, where you damage the cells in the stratum corneum over here, but is that a big deal? No, because what can you tell me about those cells anyway? They're dead anyway, right? Okay. But these capillaries in the dermal plexus right here, they get damaged slightly. They start to leak fluids a little bit, right? They dilate, so this area looks a little red. The pain fibers are irritated, so it hurts really bad. But in general, that person is really lucky, okay, with a first-degree burn. It will... they'll recover from that very nicely because the cells of the stratum basale haven't been damaged. So they'll repopulate the cells that were lost, no problem. Okay. What's the next degree? Second degree burn. A little bit deeper, right? So for sure the stratum corneum cells have all been damaged, but they're dead already, no big deal. All right, but the damage goes a little bit deeper so that these capillaries in the dermal papillae now start to leak a lot of fluid. So what do you end up with? A blister, okay, down in the dermis that pushes up on the epidermis. Again, hurts really bad, not too big of a deal because the integument is still there. It still can act as a barrier. It protects you from infection. And you really don't dehydrate when you form blisters, right? That fluid is still part of your body, all right? A little bit of a dehydration problem, but not too bad. All right, what's the next level of burn? Third degree burn, where the epidermis actually is burned off of your body. It's charred away. And let's just say that the cells are dead to this layer right here, right where I have the arrow, going right through here. Now, is that person lucky or unlucky, do you think? All right, well, I want to change your opinion a little bit. I would still say that person is lucky, okay, for the following reason, okay? Look at that stratum basale. Where does it go? All the way deep, past, deeper than the burn area. So what does that mean? There's still living stratum basale cells that are proliferating. That means this person can still grow their skin back, right? Because that layer is still there. As long as you do what for them? Protect them from infection and dehydration, right? Otherwise, you're right, they have no chance. But these cells can repopulate. So these cells are what? A reservoir that can repopulate the skin in this particular area. So that's why I think this person is still pretty lucky. As opposed to somebody that has a third degree burn that goes all the way down to the hypodermis, then what happens? No stratum basale cells anywhere. Their skin will never grow back. And so then what do they need to recover? Yeah, they need a graft. Hopefully a nice autograft and, you know, temporarily a graft from a pig or something like that, just to act as a vapor barrier and a barrier against infection, okay? So that's a good reason to know all of these different layers because it means a huge difference in how we treat patients and what the prognosis is and all that kind of stuff. So knowing layers is really, really important. All right, so what else do we see on this diagram? Some other accessory structures. when you get cold, and when you get scared. There's a little muscle right here. Here's a smooth muscle. Muscle is specialized to do what? Contract. So it's going to pull on this hair follicle, and it's going to pull the base of this hair follicle, or the root of the hair, up toward the surface of the skin, because that's where the other attachment point is. So it's going to, all right, it's going to straighten the hairs up, and it's going to kind of pull it up out of the body, forming a goosebump right here. All right, so, and the name of that muscle is called the arrector pili muscle, arrector pili. And you can see some nice innervation of the arrector pili right here. So that's one thing. And I talked about the Meissner's corpuscle for very light touch and the Pacinian corpuscle for deeper pressure and vibration. Right? There are also other free nerve endings for temperature as well as pain in the dermis. So free nerve endings for temperature and pain. There's free nerve endings on a follicle, so you can feel when wind is blowing over your skin if it's moving hair follicles around very easily, or somebody's touching hair on the surface of your body. And then the last thing are glands. We've got three major kinds of glands, and I only see two kinds on this slide right here. I see one right here, and it has this duct that goes up to the surface of the skin, and it releases a water and salty solution to the surface of the skin, and when that water evaporates, that cools you down. And so what kind of gland is this? It's a sweat gland, and in particular, it's an eccrine sweat gland. If you want to say eccrine, that's fine. I say eccrine just so that when people listen to my lectures, it's easy to understand. Okay, eccrine. Starts with an E. Okay, that's why I say it like that. Is this eccrine gland a endocrine gland or an exocrine gland? Exocrine, because it has a duct. Remember, endocrine has no ducts going anywhere. All right, so it's a particular kind of exocrine gland. Here's another exocrine gland. These are always associated with a hair follicle, and these are sebaceous glands. And sebaceous glands release more of an oil, okay, which is a waterproofing, probably has a little bit of a bacteriostatic nature to it. It's not really an antibiotic, but it helps fight bacteria. And so that just moistens the skin, lubricates the skin so it doesn't crack up. Okay, it's really terrible to have dry, cracky skin. All right, so sebaceous glands help that out. There's another gland that looks like an eccrine gland, but it's probably five times the size. It's a simple coiled tube, and that's called an apocrine gland. And that's what we had on the models in lab, the skin model of lab. It was a really big gland. And that's what we have in the axilla and inguinal region. And it's a modified sweat gland, but it releases organic solutions to the surface of the skin as well. Right? And those secretions are not odoriferous by themselves, but since they're organic, they can be used by bacteria as an energy source, and bacteria can produce an odor. All right. There are some other modified sweat glands in different parts of the body. You have some special ones in your inner, in your outer ear canal. We call that the external auditory meatus. There's a membrane that has to vibrate back and forth like a loudspeaker so that you can hear things. And it shouldn't dry out either, because if it dries out, then it would crack and fracture and you couldn't hear anything. So there's a sweat gland that releases an oily, waxy material to help lubricate the tympanic membrane. That's called a ceruminous gland. And mammary glands are modified sweat glands as well. They don't produce sweat, but they produce milk to nourish an infant. Okay. Okay, what other accessory structures? I don't know. That might be about it for accessory structures that you have to know. Sensory receptors, three kinds of glands, muscle, and hair. Ah, one other accessory structure. I got to go find it. What was the accessory structure I forgot about?
Nail.
Exactly right. So here's a nail. This even might be an exam figure, this one right here. All right. So the nail grows out away from the tip of your finger. So here you can see the free edge of the nail. And then here's the body of the nail. And the nail is made out of keratinocytes as well. So these are keratinocytes filled with keratin. And could you rank the toughness of a nail compared to skin and hair? It's probably the toughest, right? So that has the most keratin of all the keratinocytes. So it's really, really tough. And it comes out in flat sheets, not in columns. And it grows from a place that's nice and vascular right here. This is the nail matrix. Right, so the nail grows from the nail matrix, which is a little strange. You might think that it actually grows from the nail root, but that's not true. The nail root is just part of the body of the nail that is deep through the proximal nail fold. All right, so the root of the nail actually is dead keratinocytes already. Right, and it continues to get pushed out because of the nail matrix right here. And then there's a little flap of skin coming off the proximal nail fold we call the epinicium or sometimes the cuticle. And there's a little discoloration under the nail bed in this area right here that shows as the lanula. Yeah, you can see the lanula right through your fingernail. Right, and as a matter of fact, if you want to get an impression of the state of oxygenation of somebody's blood, you can actually look right through their fingernails, okay? And it should be, what, nice and pink? It shouldn't be blue, shouldn't be yellow, but somebody that's cyanotic, their fingertips would be blue. If they're jaundiced, their fingertips are going to be yellow as well as a result of that. Okay. So what kind of section does this look like to you? If you're going to say, what kind of section does this look like? What are the, how many kinds of sections are there? There's three? Okay, like, what are some examples? Sagittal is one, transverse, or coronal, or frontal. Which one does this look like to you? Okay. Well, don't forget, you got to put your body into anatomic position. So these are called digits, right? So they're going to be pointing straight inferiorly down like that. So transverse would be, okay, just across like this. That would be transverse. Coronal would be like this. All right, so what is the only kind of section that we would actually see, all right, the nail as well as a phalanx and even the anterior side of a finger right here? That would be a sagittal. That would be a sagittal section. So this is a nice sagittal section. All right, so I just wanted to demonstrate that you have to put that body part into anatomic position to know what you're looking at. All right, so bottom line is, where does a nail grow from? The nail matrix. That's right. I've known a couple people to have a fungal infection underneath their nail bed right here, and it couldn't get treated systemically, and topically it doesn't work because fungicides don't go through the nail typically very well, so it was recommended to them that the nail get removed so that it could be treated topically, all right, if it's a severe enough infection. And that's not such a big deal, because if you remove a nail, or even if you damage a nail, if you get it slammed in a car door or something, will it grow back, or won't it grow back? It'll grow back, all right? They'll form a hematoma under here, and it will grow back as long as what didn't get damaged? The nail matrix, right? So if the nail matrix is damaged, okay, then the nail won't grow back, but you can lose this whole plate right here, and then it will grow back in a couple months by itself because of the nail matrix. All right, so that's important to know. All right, so we talked about all these different kinds of glands, the nails, some functions of the integumentary system. Well, protection. Protects you against water loss, protects you against infection. Right, two main things. And it protects you against ultraviolet radiation. So you should know the chemical as well as the name of the cell that produces that chemical. And if you were to say something about that, how would you characterize or classify that chemical? What would you call it? Starts with a P. Mm-hmm. It's a pigment, right? Because it absorbs light and protects other skin structures from that light, especially ultraviolet light. Okay. Here is an insulator. But hair also protects your eyes from getting foreign bodies in it. Eyelashes and eyebrows. And nails protect the tips of your fingers, and it's also used for defense, right? Maybe not so much in humans around here, but other animals, of course, use, like your cats at home. I don't ever play with your cats and get all ripped up, right? That's nice self-defense mechanism for catching prey, okay? Another important reason for the skin is temperature regulation. There are blood vessels in the dermis, of course, in the papillary region. These blood vessels can shrink down or they can expand. When they shrink down, we call that vasoconstriction. And when something vasoconstricts, what do you think happens to blood flow through that blood vessel when it shrinks down or vasoconstricts? It decreases, right? And as it vasodilates, what happens to blood flow? It increases, right? And blood is carrying heat with it. And as you vasodilate, more heat from your body is going to go to the surface of your skin. And you can radiate it off your body. But if you're sweating, then also evaporation will cool that blood down to a large degree. And then it returns to your body cooler. So that helps reduce your body temperature, right? When you're cold, those blood vessels vasoconstrict, and that retains core body temperature so that you don't lose too much temperature and go into hypothermia. All right, so let's see what I wrote here. When your core temperature is above 98.6, are your dermal blood vessels vasoconstricted or vasodilated? Vasodilated, bringing heat from your body to the surface so that you can lose it, either through evaporation, okay. Vitamin D production. The skin needs ultraviolet light a little bit. Remember maybe 10 years ago, if you were listening to any media in the United States, everybody said, stay out of the sun, stay out of the sun, don't get any sunlight because it's damaging to the skin. Is that true? Absolutely that's true. But there's another side to that story, and that is, your skin needs some ultraviolet light to make vitamin D if you're not taking vitamin pills, right? So you need to get a little sun, but not a lot to damage your skin, right? And if you only get a little bit of sunlight to make vitamin D, you only get a little bit of skin damage. There's still some damage that takes place, but you still need vitamin D, right? And your liver has to convert this inactive form that's made by the skin to an active form so that you can absorb calcium as well as phosphate in your diet. Okay, and then of course the skin is really important for sensation. Pain, heat, cold, pressure, vibration, all those are important. All right, a lot of people are concerned about aging of the skin. And there's probably one thing that ages skin more than anything else. And guess what that is?
Sunlight.
And that is sunlight, that's right. So if you want to keep your skin as young as possible for as long as possible, for sure, don't go out in the sun and take vitamin D, right? Then you're protected all the way around. All right, so what is really happening there when your skin ages? Well, most of the age-related effects on the skin are a result of decreased vascularity. Blood supply to the skin decreases. The blood vessels get damaged. You lose blood vessels that go to the skin. And so what happens? What's in blood that's good for your skin? Oxygen and nutrients, right? Precursors to make various molecules that your skin needs, like the building blocks for triglycerides, you know, fatty acids, right? And your skin needs oxygen so it can make ATP, so that it can undergo synthetic reactions. So as a result, the skin doesn't grow quite so quickly as you get older, so the skin gets thinner and more transparent. It's transparent because the melanocytes don't have the same activity because they just don't have the same nutrients and energy supply and oxygen as they did when we were younger. So why does Why does the skin get thinner? Well, because the cells, the fibroblasts in the dermis that make collagen, right, they start to run out of nutrients and oxygen just as well. And so these cells don't make as much collagen before, so that means that somebody that's older can damage their skin much more readily, right, due to abrasion or cuts or whatever. Their skin just isn't as tough. And since the blood supply is decreased, once the skin is damaged, then it takes longer to heal. Like you might have noticed your grandma and grandpa, they cut themselves, right? It takes maybe weeks for that cut to heal, as opposed to maybe a week or so for us. And also those fibroblasts don't make nearly as much in the way of elastic fibers anymore. So remember, elastic fibers just kind of pull everything together. So when those elastic fibers go away, then our skin starts to wrinkle and sag as a result of that. All right, and that's due to what? Decreased blood supply. All right. And then the glands, like the sweat glands, in order for them to operate, guess what they need? They need a healthy blood supply. And as it's cut back, then the function of all the glands start to decrease, like the sweat glands that you use to do what? What do you use sweat glands for? The eccrine. To sweat, to cool yourself down, right? So if those sweat glands stop operating really nicely, then somebody that's elderly has a tendency to overheat very easily because they can't get rid of that heat because they just can't evaporate the same amount of water anymore. Plus, the sebaceous glands don't secrete as much oil, so somebody that's older, they have what? Typically really dry skin because those sebaceous glands stop working quite so well. Yeah. Yeah, that's probably an autonomic disorder, you know, without exercising, right?
Yeah.
So they could be like normal body temperature, but they might be sweating anyway. There are nerves that go to the sweat glands that activate the sweat glands. It's part of the autonomic nervous system. And for some reason, it's misset, and I'm not sure anybody really knows how to reset it. There can be maybe some ways to play with receptors in those sweat glands to poison some of the receptors. You know, there's a term that's coming to my mind like, it went away. I forget what it's called. Never mind. I forgot what I was going to say. But, I think it's a relatively rare condition, but it has to do with the autonomic regulation of sweat glands. So it's not a metabolic disorder, so there's, I don't think there's any vitamins you can take or diet that you can do.
With surgery.
Wow.
Using Botox for it.
Botox to poison receptors, autonomic receptors in that region.
Mm-hmm.
Botox would be a nice local way of doing it. Yeah. Hydrosis. I don't know what it's called. Okay. I can't remember. Okay. So, I guess this is pretty poignant here too, because what has been the temperature outside lately, the last couple of days? Well, it's been 105 last week. That's really hot, okay? So when it's that hot, you really got to be careful with your grandma and grandpa. Don't have them go outside, run around, mow the lawn or anything, right? Because, I mean, you probably shouldn't even do that, and you can sweat normally, but somebody in that age group can get hyperthermic so easily because they just can't cool down, because they just can't sweat the same, right? And you know what? As a matter of fact, about 10 years ago, Europe experienced a heat wave for about 2 weeks, I think. And in the summertime, what does everybody do during the summertime in Europe? It's a wonderful place to live. Well, it's like everybody goes on vacation. Hardly anybody works in July and August, including physicians, and hospitals are bare-bones staff, and everybody goes to the Mediterranean and just kind of kick back. And then they left everybody's grandparents at home, okay, especially in France. And France got really, really hot. Nobody was home taking care of them. Very few people had air conditioning because it doesn't really get that hot right there. And there were thousands and thousands of elderly people died within a couple of days of heat stroke. It was just phenomenal because nobody was around to take care of them, okay, so that just kind of underscores, as you get older, you got to be really careful with that. It was like 10,000 people in France died of heat stroke. It was just mind-boggling what happened. Okay, and of course, even for our age group, we can only sweat when what happens? When we're hot, what does our body have to have in order to sweat? You got to have water, yeah. You got to have fluids in your body, right? So when it's really hot outside, like it's been, you got to make sure that you maintain your hydration state, right? So stay well hydrated so that your body can cool itself. And as a matter of fact, what else is happening this time of year? People die of hyperthermia. I haven't heard of it this year, thank goodness. But there were high school athletes in the past that have died, college athletes, even, I need some water, even professional athletes, namely football players. Because now they're getting ready for the football season and they start doing these like two workouts a day and they go through maybe a gallon of water and they can't cool their bodies and they die of hyperthermia. They can't regulate body temperature. So even some people that should even know better, right, that can kill them. And once your body gets to a certain temperature, it's very difficult to treat, right? It's almost, it's a fatal disease that can't be stopped. Okay, and as blood supply to melanocytes decreases, they start to die, they start stop putting out melanin, so guess what happens to our hair? Yeah, well, it can fall out, but it also turns gray. Okay, it turns gray. So that happens to everybody, right? Gray hair. Because of why? You remember seeing all those? Right? See that capillary plexus in the root of this hair right here? All right, so these things, these blood vessels degenerate, and then the hair doesn't grow nearly as fast anymore. The melanocytes don't produce melanin, and our hair turns gray or white, silver, or whatever. Right, and these capillaries are very sensitive, more so than the ones up here in the dermal papillae, because, right, everybody's hair turns gray as you get older, but I've never noticed anybody's skin really to turn gray or silver as you get older. Right, so that means that these blood vessels still are functioning to a greater degree than the ones in the hair follicle right here. All right, so if you're worried about your skin getting old, can you just put cream on your skin? It's probably not going to help very much. You know, that might help lubricate the skin so it doesn't crack or whatever. But if someone wants to figure out a way to maintain the youthfulness of skin, what do we have to do? We got to figure out a way to get these blood vessels regenerated, right? So I wouldn't spend thousands of dollars on skin cream. I'd try to figure out some way to get those blood vessels working again. And probably the best way to get these blood vessels healthy again is diet and exercise, proper diet and exercise, as in most parts of the body. All right, so I think that's pretty much it for the integument. Know your layers, the different cells that are in there, the products of the different cells like melanin and collagen, keratin. Know something about these accessory structures and the nail. And that's pretty much for integument. Let me just look at all the pictures one more time. Is there anything else? Yeah, read the chapter here. You can see, what kind of gland does this look like here? That's a nice sebaceous gland. Okay. So I think that's all I need to say about the integument. I had a little tutorial someplace here. It's not for this class. It's, look at that. What do we call that? That's a broken link. Okay. All right, so here is a little integument tutorial. It's a video you can watch, but this was for a Bio 160 class, not quite at the same level of this class, but if you want to just kind of look at the other layers really quick, it's got the main layers, right? Stratum corneum, stratum basale, papillary reticular layer, I think. We talk about accessory structures a little bit in there. Okay, and all right, so we start at 3, so we're almost done. Do you want to see the histology flash quiz, if I have it, before we go? I don't know if I have it on this computer, but I think that could be helpful. Where is that? Where could it possibly be? I don't have it. This is where you should go. Okay. First, get a fast computer, faster than this one, all right, and do a Google search on DIVX, DIVX, all right, and it's just going to take you to DIVX.com, all right, and you can go right to the downloads page, all right, DIVX.com, I don't know why it's not doing better than this, all right? DVIX, here's downloads. Okay, so these are free downloads. This is the player that has worked every single time on every PC-type computer, and you can even download one for Mac. And I don't know if this works with Safari at all. Okay, it might. So these are just free downloads. So if it doesn't work in your media player, get a quick download from this one, right, just from dvix.com, and it should play. Okay, and as a matter of fact, no, before we go, let's just see if I can, no, sorry, I got to go to Blackboard. Where's Blackboard? Did I log off? Oh, sorry, I logged off. Or am I still logged in? Oh, good. Still logged on. Okay, so we're 14-something. Let's just check the link. All right, so let's download the video. I think this video, I have them in different formats because I'm not sure which format I like yet. And you could tell me which one you like. There's AVI, there's MOV, which plays in Windows Media Player. There's Flash. Flash is kind of the nicest. All right, oh, here's a WMV. So let's download this to the computer. So I'm not going to run it within Blackboard, within this frame right here. Let's download it. So let's save target as. And where should we put this? Should we put this in Dr. Goshi's file folder? No, let's put it right here, 231. All right, histology flash quiz. All right, it's what? It's almost 5 megabytes. Not trivial size, but not too big. Right, just a couple seconds, you should be able to get it. Now, what about audio in here? Oh, geez, do I have speakers? Looks like there's speakers. Okay, so we'll open this. I think it's going to open in Windows Media Player. You know, there's a lot about the audio video program that I don't know. All right. Now, this one is not captioned yet. There's just an audio track. Okay. What's that, Windows Media Player? Media Player Classic. Okay, I don't know what it is. So I didn't do anything special. But if you're having problem on your computer, update your Windows Media Player, number one, or just get the DVIX player. All right, so now, this is kind of handy because there's just random access to this file, so we can fast forward without, it's not a tape, right? You don't have to wind it one way or the other. And the other nice thing is, all right, so yeah, you can, I think you can even change the speed of this in Windows Media Player, but look, there's a pause button right there. So if you just want to look at it, here's what, some thin skin, here's a stratum basali, spinosum, granulosum, corneum. Right, but I think I just have thin skin right here. All right, so this goes over all the slides that possibly could be on the Oh, I wasn't watching. Ah, what's that? Mitosis, right? Yeah, okay, thank you. Okay, so practice this. Now, the other thing that you should do, of course, is make sure you know what these lead lines are pointing to, like nuclei of skeletal muscle. Okay, this is a skeletal muscle fiber. So I don't go over that. Yeah. And what do you got? That's thick skin. All right, and then I run through it a little bit faster speed. So again, just for repetition. Oh, that's nice, what? Elastic cartilage. And don't forget, cartilage is a connective tissue. Okay. And do you recognize these slides from anywhere? Yeah, these are slides from your book, because the slides in your book are like the best of the best pictures around, right? So you can find slides with a microscope in lab that are pretty close, but these in the book don't have any artifacts in them at all. So they're perfect learning slides, okay? All right, so if you want to do a little bit faster because it's too slow. Oh, yeah, the click didn't work real well there. Not fast enough. All right, I tell you what, before you guys go, who's got a piece of paper you can do a sign-in for me? Sign-in sheet. As soon as you sign the sign-in sheet, that's the end of class, right? Okay. Now, anybody have a problem with Blackboard and getting on and doing quizzes?